is the sweet, sweet spirit in this place. And I know that it's the spirit of the Lord. There are sweet expressions on each face, and I know they feel the presence of the
Sweet, Sweet Spirit from the Idea of North, probably Australia's premier a cappella vocal ensemble. It's a selection of our guests, someone well known for his insights into the hearts and minds of Australians all. This evening, he offers us the opportunity of some reflection on his own sense of meaning. A few weeks ago, Hugh McKay addressed an audience at Pitt Street Uniting Church in Sydney on the question, God and Me. This evening, he joins us here on Sunday night. Hugh McKay, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, John. Lovely to be with you.
Hugh, for many years you've been providing Australians with insights into the state of the nation through books like Advance Australia Where, newspaper columns and regular publications like your own McKay Report. What tempted you to venture into the field of personal reflection, particularly on the God question at this stage in your career?
Yes, an excellent question, John. And about 2 minutes before I stood up to speak, I was asking myself exactly that question because, as you say, I've really made my professional career out of being as invisible as possible and trying to simply present what I learn about contemporary Australia and hold up some kind of mirror. I mean, I've seen it in a way as my mission in life to try and explain us to ourselves and to try and stay out of the argument, even though at various times I have been accused of having a prejudiced interpretation because of my own religious upbringing, although that upbringing seems so remote now that I reject the charge of prejudice. But I suppose I was invited to give the lecture on God and me as part of a series that the Pitt Street Uniting Church in Sydney conducts. I was pleased to be asked because it is a question which is central, I think, for all of us. I mean, whether you regard yourself as a theist or an atheist, and if you're a theist, whether you regard yourself as a Christian, and if you're a Christian, whether you regard yourself as a Protestant or a Catholic or a nonconformist or none of the above, it seems to me the God question is central for all of us. We do at some stage have to decide whether this means anything to us or nothing to us. And in fact, I said my mission in life was to explain us to ourselves. I think I've got a bit of a new mission in a way, which is I'd love to find a way of dissolving the tension, the conflict that arises from the varieties of religious faith and religious labels. In fact, I think I'd die a happy man if I had found some kind of bridge between theists and atheists, because the older I get and the more I listen to people with religious faith talking to each other or attacking each other, and the more I introspect into my own journey and my own present situation, the more the difference between the theist and the atheist seems to me not exactly to evaporate, but to be so much a question of words, because I've come to the view that God is love. And so whether you decide to call the compassion, the love, the charity that's within you God or not, it seems to me not to be really a central question at all.
It's an interesting observation you make in that, as you say, you begin to dissolve the boundaries between the theists and the non-theists. It's a journey that other people have also been, in some ways, accused by the press of making. One could look at the recent comments about Clive Hamilton, that he's gone all mystical on us, another observer of Australia as a nation. Also a scientist like Charles Birch, who for many years has worked towards an understanding of God that's linked to science in a way that's understood as process theology, which seems to dissolve the boundaries between theism and non-theism.
Yes. Yeah, I'd be more than happy to be roughly bracketed with the people that you've just described. Because when I look at what seem to be the raging conflicts, I mean, you look at Dawkins, for example, Richard Dawkins, the God delusion, Christopher Hitchens' God Is Not Great, this sort of spate of books espousing atheism that we've had. And you look at the rise of fundamentalism, Pentecostalism, what you might describe as kind of hard right evangelical or fundamentalist Christianity, not only in Australia but around the world. I mean, that kind of fills me with despair because what Dawkins, of course, has done has compared the worst of religion with the best of science and come up with a not very surprising answer. But really, does anyone dispute the idea that love conquers all? Does anyone dispute the idea that the greatest of all human motivations, the thing that animates the human spirit in the most positive and productive way is love. Now, I don't think Dawkins would argue with that. He would say, but look what religion has done with that idea. And of course, I'd agree with him. I'm very persuaded by much of what Dawkins says. I think religion has, organized religion, the institutional church, has comprehensively mucked it up by confusing this very simple question. The idea that the kingdom of heaven is within you, that the person who abides in love abides in God and God's abiding in him. These are very simple. I mean, I'm taking out of the Christian tradition. We could equally talk about other religious traditions with the same central idea. But these are very, very simple ideas which don't require the leap of faith that the traditional view, the out there, the external view of God as the kind of mission control for mankind, the creative being that's out there somewhere, controlling, manipulating, intervening. I mean, that leap of faith, which I once took, that leap of faith, the leap of faith in that direction seems to me bizarre. A much more helpful, a much more productive, a much more healing leap of faith, it seems to me, is the leap that embraces the idea that love is powerful, and that when we talk about God in the world or the work of God, we're talking about love in the world. We're talking about the work of love, which is the hardest work of all, but that's what it is. It's not, there's not some other kind of thing. It's mysterious, but it's essentially interior, not exterior.
You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia and through Radio Australia and the World Wide Web around the world. Our guest is Hugh McKay, social researcher into the minds and meanings of Australian life. Hugh, let's have a piece of music, because this opens up a whole other way of approaching the sense of meaning, the aesthetic journey. You've chosen a number of selections of music which do reflect this. The first is Bruckner from the Croydon Singers, Os Justi. Why?
I'm an absolute devotee of Bruckner's motets. Locus Iste, I think, is perhaps the jewel in the crown. I find this kind of music, John, to be sublime. I do find it inspiring. And I think many people who experience something that you might want to call religious experience or a spiritual experience or insight, inspiration, do find that music is a great spur to it. I certainly find that. Now, what does that mean? Does it mean it puts us in touch with this creative super being? No. To me, what it does is provides us with a kind of theatre, a place where we can go, where we can encounter this idea that love is the supreme force in human existence. And Locus Iste is a motet about this is the place where God is. And of course, God is where we are in a loving spirit.
Bruckner, Locus Iste. You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia. John Cleary with you. My guest, Hugh McKay. Hugh, let's talk a little about the journey for you, the personal journey. You've already mentioned that you grew up within a community that put an immense store in questions of ultimate value. In fact, you grew up in a traditional conservative Baptist community, yet at a point you developed reservations about that. So I guess the first relevant question is, how committed to that community were you, and at what point did a breach come for you? What was the trigger that caused you to say, no, I need to move away from this?
Well, the answer to the first question is that I was deeply committed. And when I talked to some of the people that I grew up with, I think perhaps I was even more committed than most of my friends, even though I thought they were just as committed as I was. No, I was an absolute Bible believer. I was, I guess you'd say, a fundamentalist. And for several years of that early adolescent and young adult journey, I would have probably envisaged myself going into the ministry of the church in that very hardline fundamentalist tradition. Now,
did that come out of your parents, or was it?
Well, I think I was more extreme than they were, to be frank. They were certainly very devout. They were very regular churchgoers. They raised my brother and me in that tradition of church every Sunday until you were old enough to go twice on Sunday, but also Sunday school and other activities. Sunday was a packed day. And so right from the very beginning, I had this sense of being a Christian, being in that tradition, and trying to make sense of the world and of myself within that tradition. So I did have what I now see as all the terrible blind spots, all the flaws of that position built in. So I did have the view of God as an external creative force with a personal interest in my life, able to intervene, control the world, etc.
You never had any small reservations in the corner, your childlike apprehensions?
Not during childhood and adolescence. I'm embarrassed to say that, John. I mean, I would like to be able to say to you that I was plagued with doubt, but you see, I think that faith of the best kind, the kind I was talking about a few minutes ago, is always plagued with doubt. I mean, we live by faith because of our doubts. We have to believe in whatever it is we believe in that we call God because of our uncertainties. The mark of the true fundamentalist, the extreme case, is the complete absence of doubt, which in a way, and I don't want to offend any listeners by saying this, but in a way is a bit like the complete absence of faith. It's as though it's not faith anymore. It's just an absolute conviction of rightness, a black and white certainty that we've got the answer, and anyone who thinks differently from us simply has missed the point, has not got the answer. Well, many years after I abandoned all that, a very wise, in fact, an Anglican priest said to me, well, of course, if you have that kind of upbringing, the only possibility is that you have to go through a painful separation. You have to go out into some kind of wilderness before you can come back to the God question with any kind of sensible or open perspective on it, which is pretty much what happened to me.
I did an epiphany of unbelief.
Yeah, that's right. A good way of putting it, but it was a bit slow in coming. And I am, when I reflect on this, I am embarrassed about it. But it was really, I was well into my 20s before it began occurring to me that the literal Bible believing thing was just silly and unnecessary. That stories like the virgin birth, the miracles, the idea that Christianity could be right and Islam or Judaism could be wrong in some fundamental way. There was only one pathway to an understanding of God and the way in which that might illuminate our understanding of the meaning of our lives. All of that came to me mainly as a result of some very robust debate that I had. In fact, when I was working at the ABC, strangely enough, in the audience research department here at the ABC, I worked with some really outstanding researchers at that time, very stimulating, bright people, all of whom had had, of one kind or another, deep immersion in religious traditions and had all broken free of it. And here I arrived in the group, and they couldn't believe that I was still clinging to some of this stuff. And so I engaged over some years in debate about all of that, which led me...
This would have been the mid-60s, early 70s.
Yeah. Early 60s.
The beginning of the whole sort of open question about theology as well, because you began to have a community which was willing to debate issues which they'd never had before. John Robinson and Honest to God, Harvey Cox and the Secular City. Books like this were beginning to come out, weren't they? People were sort of opening the windows.
Exactly. You mentioned there two books that were seminal for me, Harvey Cox, Secular City, and John Robinson, Honest to God, both highly formative. And an absolute revelation to me. I mean, I suppose I was waiting to read and hear this kind of stuff because when I came across it, it really was like the scales falling from my eyes and saying, well, yes, of course.
If you're waiting to hear it, there must have been something building up in within you, which was questioning where you had come from. What particular aspects of the belief system you were brought up were beginning to trouble you?
The idea of God as a controlling entity, I began to see as delusional and even potentially a bit destructive. I mean, I was still trying to cling to it and find some way of making sense of it, but I could see that one of the problems with it was that it made people not just incredibly arrogant because they thought that they had, and I had previously thought, some kind of privileged access to the mind of this particular kind of God. But it also led to a curious kind of fatalism, John. This idea that, well, God's in control, God's pulling the strings. I mean, we're just the pawns in this game, and so leave it all to God and everything will be okay. Whatever happens is going to be the will of God if you've given yourself up to this external being who's manipulating and controlling the universe. I began to be pretty uncomfortable with that.
And in a conservative era too, in a Cold War era, conservative religion was very much characterised when debates on the atom bomb occurred or others of saying, well, you know, I can actually remember a discussion with Fred Nile at one point in which he offered the suggestion that perhaps, you know, Armageddon might well fit into the will of God. I mean, these things were... It was a pretty strange period in some ways.
It was. Looking back on it, I was very glad to be in the thick of it because it was both a strange period but also a period that was, for someone like me, was inevitably going to produce a great leap of growth in my thinking. But yes, I mean, even today, of course, there are people who have wondered whether George W. Bush has had some of the reckless foreign policy initiatives that he's had precisely because he still has that idea that, you know, God is controlling all this, Armageddon is around the corner, I'm just the servant of this God, and if I'm going to bring fire raining down on the planet, well, so be it. I mean, I can't imagine being inside the head of someone who thinks like that, except that I can recall what it would have been like.
You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio Around Australia. John Cleary with you, my guest, Hugh McKay, social researcher and commentator on we as an Australian people, who's giving us the benefit of his understandings of perhaps how he came to the views he holds about life. Hugh, another piece of music. This one is from Charles Villiers Stanford, a wonderful song called The Bluebird. But actually, Stanford represents an era, which I wonder in some ways, is it not reflective of what you're actually talking about, in that Stanford is one of those composers, along with Elgar and a little later Vaughan Williams, who are steeped in the church and in religion and understand it, yet at the same time are questioning the fundamental notions of God. The Edwardian era was marked by the rise of science and the beginning of people walking away from the idea of God as conventionally conceived. And these composers existed very much in that milieu.
That's very true, John. It's a sort of post-Enlightenment episode, in a way, in a lot of creativity. especially music, as you say, from composers who came out of what was a very conservative Christian tradition and then became more liberal. And of course, that means that a lot of what they wrote still has this wonderfully mystical quality about it. And the song we're about to hear is, of course, not a sacred song at all. I mean, it's a secular song, but it has all of that wonderful mysticism in it, which was so characteristic of Stanford.
The Bluebird, Stanford. You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio. Hugh McKay is our guest, author of The McKay Report and a number of books, including perhaps Advance Australia Where, which struck a chord with many Australians over the last few years. Hugh McKay, we've talked about the journey, your journey away from organised religion and institutional religion. Let's talk for a moment about the sorts of things we raised just in that piece of music, the Stanford piece of music, this sense of the numinous, this sense that there are things around which questions of ultimate value do cohere. Mm. And that's something that we all grapple with, as you've alluded to.
Yes, we do. And it's not surprising that for some people, the grappling leads to the idea that there is something beyond us, which then leads to the step that the something beyond us is an entity, not a person. I guess there are people don't think of God as being a being in the flesh and blood sense, but a spirit that has some kind of identity which is separate from us. It's not surprising that many people cling to that idea and derive great comfort from that idea, and much of the liturgical life of the institutional church appears to be reinforcing that idea, that out there is God the Spirit, whom we must worship and whose will we must obey, and so on. There's another way of grappling with all that, or another conclusion that the grappling could lead to, which is that, yes, God is a spirit, and the spirit is in here. And no less wonderful, no less numinous, no less mysterious, no less powerful for being in here. We talk about the spirit of love. We talk about the spirit of the Olympics. You know, we talk about the ethos of an organization. That all makes sense. I think we all understand what we mean by that. It doesn't seem to me that we have to depart from that kind of language when we're talking about God. God is the spirit of love within us and among us. A wonderful thing to be worshipped, to be nurtured, to be set apart, to be recognized as the noblest of human impulses, which will need nurture, which will need care, which will probably need some kind of rituals, some kind of practices, some kind of mindfulness that will help us to preserve this. Because, of course, in our own minds, in our own souls, if you prefer the mystical term, we don't just have the spirit of love waiting to permeate our lives and make us wonderful and noble creatures. We also have much darker impulses. The mind is a battlefield between good and evil, between love and more destructive impulses like envy and hate and prejudice and so on. They're all there. They're all within us. And the struggle, if we believe, and I think most people, not all people, but I think most people would intuitively believe that we are better off and the world is a better place if love prevails, if the noble impulses prevail. So we do have to work at it. And at its best, I think you'd say the practices of the institutional church, particularly the liturgical practices, are about creating places and creating an environment, creating music, structures of various kinds that encourage us for an hour or two a week maybe to reflect on all of this and to nurture the idea that there is this inherent goodness, there is this spirit of love within us, which will be incredibly powerful if it's nurtured, but which can be overshadowed by the dark stuff.
You mentioned liturgical practices, and of course liturgy is something developed over centuries through formulation and reformulation and understanding. Yet the most dynamic areas of religious growth tend to be in those areas which concentrate not on the interior, but on the exterior, on the experiential, the charismatic, if you like. Are you suggesting that these are, in fact, two utterly different sorts of religion? That is, that the experience of Hillsong and that sort of charismatic experience is in some ways about a different sort of God.
Well, I assume that it is.
It's a tradition you come out of in the yeah. Baptist Church that has elements of both.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I assume that it is because I see and hear in that kind of movement echoes of my own upbringing, which I associate with a completely different view of God from the view that I have now, which I would see, and this is a very personal reflection, which I would see as an unhelpful and potentially destructive view of God, because it's not just about the good, the love within us being encouraged and nurtured and reinforced and then acted out, but it's about the construct of a God in our own image, in a sense, a God that is some kind of focus for our prejudices or our aspirations or whatever it might be. Now, I don't, of course, mean by that to denigrate everyone who's involved in charismatic fundamentalist Pentecostalism or other forms of Christianity, because I assume, and I want to be charitable about this, of course, I assume that the purpose at the end is the same. The purpose is to bring out the best in us, to I mean, people in that tradition certainly say God is love.
But you're also a social psychologist saying the things people do betoken something of who and what they are, of their ultimate aspirations. And you're saying that the ways in which people worship in some way reflect their deepest aspirations or their deepest understandings. And looking at those, say, the more in-depth, liturgical, reflective, meditative style of worship and the Hillsong style or the charismatic style reflect profoundly different understandings of the nature of God in community.
Yes, that is true. I certainly do believe that, but I don't want to then go from there to say, and you know, these people are wrong and it's all hopeless, because what I'm about is trying to build a bridge and trying to encourage even people in that tradition to say, but boil it all down. What is this really about? Is it not really about the idea that love in the world is the most powerful agent, that the spirit of love is the spirit that can animate us in the most positive and productive way? If that's what it's about, then we're really on the same wavelength. And so are plenty of atheists who don't want to use the word God in their language at all, but who would still subscribe to what I've just said. I mean, ironically, I would say some of my most godly friends and acquaintances would never use the word God, but I see godliness, I see holiness, which is a quaint old-fashioned word for wholeness. I see signs of their wholeness, of their loving kindness every day. But they'd be offended if I said, oh, so this is the God in you that's being expressed. They would say, well, you know, let's apply Occam's razor. You don't need that concept. All I'm saying is, it's a concept that helps me to make sense of even the extreme charismatics motivation, but also the motivation of the more mystical, reflective kind.
Institutional religion, you're fairly tough on it. But at the same time, as a social psychologist, you're one who recognises that it's institutions that give our society structure and meaning. It's what enables a society to sustain itself. The educational institutions and the nature of those institutions is profoundly important to who we are as a society. So there's a sense in which institutional religion, for all its faults, is in some sense a valuable bearer or container of some sense of engagement with the ultimate.
Yeah, I agree with that, John. I'd also make one other point, which is it's inevitable. I mean, there is no doubt that in human societies we organize ourselves in ways that produce institutions, whether they're institutions associated, as you say, with education or with health or with employment or with politics or with sport, or with religion, or more broadly, spirituality. That's the way we tend to do it. And in all those areas, whether we're talking about religion or whether we're talking about education, there we need to understand that there is a huge hazard once we've begun to institutionalize our practices or our beliefs. And the hazard, of course, is that we become dogmatic, that we fix things in dogma, and then we become arrogant. So whether it's a particular kind of sporting coach who thinks he has the truth and institutionalizes his truth in a particular way of training athletes, and that becomes dogmatic and prejudiced and so on, or whether it becomes someone with a particular religious insight, which is incorporated as dogma into the life of a religious institution, the hazard is exactly the same in both cases. We cease being open to growth. We cease being open to proper dialogue with people who come out of different belief systems or different traditions. I think the institutional church, it's a real paradox, because everything you said about it is right, and it's the institutionalization of religion, the introduction of dogmatic theology into institutionalized religion, that's led to all kinds of excesses violence, abuse, war, repression. You know, the litany of things that have gone wrong as a result of institutionalizing our spiritual lives is very long. Yet at the same time, it's true that people love to congregate to explore these deeper questions, the numinous, etc.
And even in a society like Australia, if it wasn't for institutional religion, much of the welfare structures of this society would still be in deep trouble.
Well, I'd have two comments about that, John. I think you've just made a very controversial remark, in fact. First of all, I accept that in our society where there is very, very low church attendance, only about 15% of Australians attend church once a month or more often, so we're not a nation devoted to religious practice. Nevertheless, what you've just said is very widely said. People think of the presence of the church in our society as a generally positive presence. And in fact, one of the things I've found as a researcher over the years is that there's a great envy of people of faith. People without faith often wish they believed in something a bit more coherent than their present belief system. But the thing that's controversial, I think, about what you've said is that although it is literally true that much of the welfare work that is done in the community is done through religious agencies or agencies of the institutional church, we do have to recognize that not all is, that there are many excellent secular welfare agencies as well, and that there is another risk in welfare that is religiously based, which is, I remember seeing a sign outside a school in rural New South Wales, or a preschool, which said, "We serve God by caring for children." And at first I thought, that's quite unexceptionable. That sounds good. They're nailing their colours to the mast. And then I thought about it and I thought, now, presumably the children and the parents of the children would like to think that they were serving the children, that they were meeting the needs of the children, that the idea that we're doing this because we're serving God, we're only doing this as an expression of faith, I'm increasingly inclined to think is a rather worrying position.
Yes, it speaks of exploitation. That is, it's buying an insurance policy for yourself, not for the sake of the kid.
Yeah, that's right. Mm. That's right. Let's serve each other because we are all in need, and we all need to be taken seriously, and we all need our problems attended to and our wounds bound up, etc. But let's do that for each other in a spirit of love, not because we're saying, well, I'm doing this because of my faith in God. The next question, of course, is, oh, so what if your faith changed or you lost it? Would you no longer be interested in caring for the sick?
Mm. You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio. Hugh McKay with you. We're going to have another piece of music. This is somebody who I think sort of probably reflects your sense of the synthesis, Bach, the great synthesizer in a way. Siciliano in G minor, and it's the Jacques Lussier Trio. Why have you chosen this version?
Well, we couldn't have a program of any kind of music without a nod in the direction of J.S. Bach. And again, the great thing about Bach is that everything he wrote was in some way about God. And for me, that is to say, it's in some way about the inner life, about the possibilities of a genuinely loving spirit transforming us and transforming the world. But the thing I love about Lussier, of course, is that he brings all of the improvisational skills and the special insights of jazz to the work of Bach, gives it a bit of a swing, which I think gives us a very, very interesting modern perspective on what the master was writing.
The music of J.S. Bach from the Jacques Lussier Trio. You're on Sunday nights on ABC Radio. John Cleary with you, our guest Hugh McKay. Hugh, we've cantered around the turf quite a bit. We haven't got that much time left, but let's talk about contemporary spirituality, what the word means for you, and whether or not and how you find it relevant to yourself.
Being a social researcher, I can't help responding first by saying that I'm intrigued by what's happening in Australian society, which is a great surge of interest in this thing called spirituality. Even among people who very deliberately want to distance themselves from religion or from the institutional church, there is a real difference in people's minds between the word religion and the word spirituality. And I guess the essence of the difference is religion stands for dogma and for set practices and hoops that you have to jump through, whereas spirituality has to do with being more closely in touch with our deepest urges, being clear about our values, being open to much more positive, loving impulses. That, to me, is what people in general seem to be striving towards, a recognition after, well, particularly the last decade of rampant materialism in Australia, racking up record levels of personal and household debt to fund our self-indulgence and our materialist binge, a recognition that in the end, of course, that isn't what life is about. Life is about the quality of our relationships with each other. It's about the extent to which we attend to the needs of the poor and the marginalised and the disadvantaged. It's about the extent to which we build a harmonious society out of people who've come here from about 180 different birthplaces around the world. These are not material questions. These are non-material, which I take to mean spiritual questions. And I think Australia has entered a new phase of openness to debate.
You go into church these days. You've returned to actually the building, but the building as part of a reflective experience for you. So worship itself does have some meaning for you now, or it's beginning to have some meaning.
That's true, John. I sometimes wonder when I do attend a church service, I wonder what's going on in the minds of all the other people and whether what's going on in my mind is rather out of step and might even be disapproved of, because there are many of the practices of the church, many of the creeds and other liturgical things that I can't really say I'm wholeheartedly participating in.
So what takes you back inside the building?
Well, the big spur is music and the idea of a space set aside, and people who are interested in creating spaces set aside for this kind of reflection, to think about love's work, to think about the presence of love in my mind, in my spirit, the way that might act out in my relationships and more broadly in the world, and to contemplate what a transformed place the world might be if this thing which I would happily just call love, but would equally happily call God, the spirit of love within us, were set free, were unleashed through the lives of people who really believe in this. So it wouldn't have to be a church, but churches are a very convenient place with a long tradition of encouraging people to think along these lines. But I have to be frank and say that if by entering a church it's assumed that I'm therefore subscribing to everything that goes on, particularly in the realm of dogma, well then I'm there under false pretenses.
The attitude you reflect, I suspect, is shared by many listeners to a program such as this. I mean, the most common observation I get from people who ring into this program is, look, I used to go to church, but... And most of them then go on to say they still have some deep sense of attachment to all that's valuable about religion. It can't cop the imposition, the demand that they subscribe to a certain set or a certain form of values. It's a characteristic of the try before you buy society at its cheapest level, but at another level it's a reflection of something more, perhaps deeper and more honest.
I think that's true, John. And I think although the growth seems to be at the other end of the spectrum where people are signing up to a particular set of beliefs, almost prescriptive beliefs and dogma, a particular way of going about religious practice, there's a huge group in the community. The vast majority of people are not signing up for that kind of religious experience. There's a huge group of people who are nevertheless interested in the good life, in the civil society, in having loving, productive relationships, in caring for the sick and the poor and all of those things, but who would be looking for somewhere that would accept them with all of their half-formed ideas and all of their doubts about more traditional definitions of faith. And of course, it's fortunate that there are such communities within the church and on the fringes of the church that exist, that will accept that it's the role of groups of like-minded people, who in this context happen to be Christians, to look at the needs of the world and respond to those needs, rather than saying, look here, we've got all these rules and regulations and dogmatic positions and so on. If you're prepared to tick the boxes, you can be one of us. That's still a very traditional view of the institutional church, but it's got nothing to do with a loving response to a wounded society.
An appropriate place in which to conclude our discussion, Hugh McKay, with a piece of music that perhaps gives reflection to that. Schubert, A Song Without Words. Hugh, why?
Well, I'm a great fan of Schubert, and in particular of his songs without words. And I think Schubert is the only composer in history who was courageous enough to call a piece of music to music. So here is a little gem by Schubert, which is itself devoted to the celebration of the role of music in our lives and I would say in our spiritual journeys. Music, the great inspirer, the great uplifter, the great trigger for reflection about all the things that are good and loving and noble in us. And here is Schubert prepared to write a piece of music which is devoted to music.
Hugh McKay, thanks for joining us on Sunday night.
My pleasure. Thank you, John.